Hey there, we're about to talk about something a little squeamish, sex education, and the conversation gets a little graphic. So if you think that might not be your thing or your family's thing, you have my permission to turn the radio to K-Rock for a few minutes. Here we go. You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're starting out in Pomona, outside the office of a California state senator. It's a protest, a small one. Maybe a dozen people are here. They're all holding up signs and cheering when supportive cars honk as they drive by. Lying Leyva. The chant is directed at State Senator Connie Leyva. She chairs the California Senate's Education Committee, which decides how sex education is taught in California public schools. One of the parents you hear chanting is Michelle New. She works at home some days so she can homeschool her 12-year-old daughter. She remembers how sex ed was taught when she was a girl.
Sex education taught safety. It taught reproductive. It taught puberty. It did teach condoms and birth control and things like that, but it didn't go over and beyond sexual beliefs. And this curriculum does. You don't see any middle of the ground. You don't see anything that doesn't have an agenda. It's all agenda driven.
Sex education has a long history of controversy, but it's not just putting condoms on bananas anymore. The fight has been reinvigorated this school year after California passed a new framework with books and PowerPoints and other resources to help teachers through sex education. And now Michelle New is one of thousands of parents up and down California who are fighting that curriculum. And with me to talk about it is KCRW's Kaylee Wells, who's been reporting on this story. Hi, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
So what is actually new? Why are parents so mad? They say agenda. What do they mean by that?
Right. So, well, the fight's actually been building for a few years since the new curriculum started back in 2016. The reason it's kind of bigger this year is because all of those resources that are recommended to teachers to get through that curriculum, that was passed back in May. So this is the first school year where parents have proof of what their kids are seeing. But the short answer of why they're mad, it's too graphic. It's too detailed of descriptions. The descriptions are too encouraging of sexual practices. And there's not enough focus on the consequences of being sexually active.
So that's what they mean when they say agenda. There's the agenda of, like, oversexing our children.
That's
right?
What they're saying.
Yeah. So you say explicit, but really, what does explicit mean? I mean, how far does this curriculum really go?
So I actually posed that question to Stephanie Yates. She was another parent out at that protest. Her oldest son is a freshman, and he's actually been pulled out of public school, too. She actually took out one of the originally recommended books to just prove how explicit it really is.
It says blood play. Okay, so it's about HIV, body fluid, blood play. Not only that, it says, what is it and how do you do it? Some people enjoy any number of body fluids sexually.
So she reads on. I'm not really comfortable putting it on air. It also brings up how to participate in oral sex, fisting. It gets really explicit in its detail, and it is pretty instructional.
All right, and here we are talking about it on the radio. So obviously, it's a bit taboo with us, and I would imagine some more conservative people are thinking to themselves, wow, this is really over the top. What do parents have to say about this?
Some parents think it's a big enough deal that they're taking their kids out of school. So Yates and New, like we said, they've both pulled their kids out. They're homeschooling or doing private school. They're also mad because there are some recommended resources and videos that the kids get that they can watch on their own time. So if you follow the recommended link of a recommended link of a recommended link, and I did test this myself, you can successfully get to porn.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's the internet, though, right? I mean, it takes you down a rabbit hole. You click this and then that something else happens and then, you know.
That's true. But parents are not so happy that it comes from originally a source that your school says is okay. The other controversial part here, the framework encourages teachers to use LGBTQ inclusive language. So it's supposed to make all students feel comfortable. So in your sex ed class, that could mean you're not talking about just a male and a female together, talking about a female and a female together, a male and a male together. And so you're acknowledging multiple genders and sexes and sexual orientations, but that also means different sex positions than maybe the traditional one you learned about 20 or 30 years ago.
It's not just that gay intercourse is included in this or gay people are included in this.
Correct. It would just be the positions that you might see more frequently in gay couplings. And they're worried that their kids might experiment with anal sex and oral sex and things like that.
And I mean, do they have a problem if perhaps they believe that their child might be bisexual or transgender? I mean, is that a part of this as well?
Some say yes. They say it goes against their religion to encourage ways of life like that. But others just say, my kid is too young to be thinking that way. But because of the diversity and inclusion piece of this, it doesn't just happen in sex ed. It happens in all of their courses. So that kind of conversation starts in elementary school. And unlike sex ed, you can't opt out of that conversation happening in all those other classes. So here's Linda Liu. She's another mom I met. She's showing me her fourth grade son's homework. And he was drawing comics about biological males wearing dresses and gay people coming out to their friends and being accepted. So is this work that your kid did for
gender identity? They're 14 years old. Without our notice, I know it, she know it, 1 month later, after we finish all the curriculum. Yeah, after all the curriculum finish.
Why does teaching sexual orientation at 9 years old, 10 years old, why does that bug you?
For the age at 10, before the pubescent age, the most important to understand themselves. Too complicated information to the 10 years old kid is not age appropriate.
Parents are very concerned about their children, obviously, and they have a right to be. But then, you know, if you talk to administrators, if you talk to the people who are behind the curriculum, what do they say about this? This is important for children to know because of the repercussions.
That's true. That is a big argument that the politicians are making. As far as the administrators, and this is a big frustration of parents, it's actually really hard to find out. I think I tried maybe half a dozen districts trying to get comments from them, and they were either saying nobody was available in the month-long window I had for this story, or they just plain said no to talking.
Really?
Yes. I only actually got one statement. It was from LAUSD. They just said that they have a long history of providing comprehensive health education, and their work is a model for the country, but that's it. In terms of politicians, Connie Leva, she leads the state Senate Education Committee. You heard the protesters outside her office before. She wouldn't comment to me either, but there is sound of her during a public hearing where they were debating sex ed last month, and the residents there got pretty upset.
As a mother of 27-year-old twin daughters who had sex education in public schools, I did not feel that it was not age appropriate. I had the opportunity as a parent to review the material if I went into the school and ask for it, which I believe all parents have that right now. There's nothing in there that is not age appropriate. I don't lie. You may disagree.
I mean, I remember sex education from decades ago. It wasn't like this.
Right.
When you look at it, you can understand the parents would be a little squeamish about this for their children. You can also look at it from the administrator's point of view and say, you know, we have some of the issues we have as far as disease, as far as, you know, unexpected pregnancies, things like that, because children don't know.
Right. And you can objectively say there is a big difference between what we were learning then and what they're learning now. And you can objectively say, yes, a lot of it is instructional. And maybe the way that it's being painted is what's making the parents so uncomfortable.
It's not going away, obviously. And it's something that you're going to keep tabs on, right?
Of course.
Keep trying to talk to the administrators and to the people in the state who passed this and to the parents as well and see whether they are accepting this or not.
Absolutely.
KCRW's Kaylee Wells covering California's public school sex education. Kaylee, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, California's progressive sex education may have stirred up some controversy, but it's not hard for students across the country to find much more explicit content online. There was a study done a couple of years ago by a group called Tech Sex, and it said nearly a quarter of teens and young adults trust search engines more than any other source to learn about sex and reproductive health. That's why a market has popped up of social media influencers and other young adults who are openly talking about sex online. With me to talk about it is Shan Boudram, or as her half million YouTube subscribers know her, Shan Booty. She's a sexologist who talks about the intimate and the uncomfortable online. She also authored the book, The Game of Desire. Shan, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
This is a subject, Shan, that can get derailed, though, in many ways. And here I am, this middle-aged guy on the radio, right, talking to a sexologist about sex education. So I want you to start off with making me not uncomfortable talking about that.
This is how you got here, right? It's not a very complicated, I think at the end of the day, we've spent a lot of time separating ourselves from our sexuality and separating people in general, right? Like whether it be elderly people, oh, they don't do that, or whether it be even youth, they don't think about that. We spend a lot of time trying to detach ourselves from our sexual self, but the truth of the matter is, since you were in the womb and even before that, you know, sexuality has been a part of all of our stories. And I think that if we just embrace that as a norm and not this thing that only happens on Fridays on some occasions, it just gets a lot easier.
What is it that you're providing on YouTube that maybe sex education in schools and classrooms is not?
I think unfiltered information. I think I'm providing people an opportunity to create discernment for themselves. I think in many ways I'm doing what the school system should do. I think that the school system has an incredible opportunity to be the primary sexual educator because you're doing it where it matters most amongst people who are going to have these discussions together. I think that, you know, while it is a very brave thing to do to take on youth sex education, I do think that we should always be allotting resources to pushing the school system to be the primary source because to me, that's where the most effective work can get done.
So with all due respect, Shan, what makes you qualified to be the person to talk about this? Like what are your credentials besides, hey, I'm on YouTube and a lot of people watch me?
I started off when, you know, in 2008 or so, I was in school for journalism. And as you know, in journalism school, they say, write what you know, like whatever it is that drives you, that you look up in your free time, that's what you should be writing about. So my first book was really like a journalistic approach to sexuality. It was called Laid, Young People's Experiences with Sex in an Easy Access Culture, which was published in 2009. And then after that, there's a school called University of Toronto, where I'm from, and they have a CE program to become a sex education counselor. So I took that and then I worked there for a number of years. And as a sex education counselor to university students, you're just by and large like informing them about different options for contraceptive, where to go if something looks weird. And then after that, I moved to California and I got my associate in sex education at the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. And then I became certified as a sexologist at the same institute. But ultimately, if I can tell you my best educator has been people. I think by allowing myself to be known as a go-to in this space, people are comfortable coming to me. And I always get a DM or an email about a question or a condition or a fetish or a way of sexually engaging that I've never heard of before. So I feel like I'm in school every single day and the people are my teachers.
What are some of the biggest questions that you get as a sex educator, somebody who listens to all of these things? I mean, what's the biggest thing that people talk to you about?
You know, what's really fascinating is that kind of to your point, search engines are really the biggest sex educator. They are probably the most poignant and impactful. So I think long gone are the days where anybody who's in this space as a go-to is getting the basics of why is my period 3 days late? Or if I'm a woman, how do I orgasm? Or if I'm a man, like, why is my sex drive so high? So all those basic questions that I think used to be sort of what you would get as an educator, Google gets instead. So that means that all of my questions are paragraphs. It tends to be like a long drawn out story and really nuanced. Because again, if you could Google it, you're probably going to go to that first.
The internet is like throwing spaghetti at the wall. Everything is out there. Does that make your job harder?
I think it can make it harder or easier. I think that's even if, you know, parents ask me, like, what should I tell my kids about sex or what should the talk consist of? I'm just always like, the talk is the wrong answer. It has to be the ongoing conversation. I think the greatest thing that you can give anybody, whether you are 13 and just getting the urges or you're 33 and trying to figure things out for yourself, is discernment. You have to have some type of knowledge base to decipher between what's real and what's fake. I think porn really does exist in that category. So there are outlets out there, but if you don't have the discernment to decide what's real from what's fake, what's useful from what's fantastical, that's when it can be really dangerous. I think that people should be taught about porn the same way that we're taught about WWE wrestling. Like there's this widespread understanding that this is for entertainment value. Yeah. You can watch it as a tool to express your desires or as an entertainment or as something to do that can enhance your sexuality. But if you're taking it literally and it's really not the right platform, that's when the true damage comes in.
I wonder, because what we're talking about here is, you know, the proliferation of pornography on the internet, and whether sex educators in these classrooms are prepared for all of that, or has it, I mean, do you think they're even responsive to what people have access to?
I think if you're a good educator and you're existing in that exact same space where you're allowing the students to inform you and to drive the discussion, you can be very successful, because they're going to let you know what it is that they're being exposed to, what they've heard of. That's the time to start opening it up to the people who are in the class to kind of figure out what direction it is that they need to go in based on what's happening in the schoolyard.
Why do you think there's so much shame involved in sex, do you think? Why is this such a tough subject to talk about?
You know, it's, I think religion plays a massive part in that. It's almost like a family heirloom, right? Like, shame is something that we pass down from one generation to the next. It's fear, because I think that, you know, sex is extremely powerful. You know, you can create a life, you can destroy a life, you can enhance a life. So it's just like a bad joke that just keeps getting passed down from generation to generation. And I think that if you're kind of tired of that rhetoric, that's when embracing education systems like California, or embracing platforms even like mine that you think have done the research and can do a better job, so we can put an end to this bad joke.
And by the way, it's one of the biggest, you know, parts of human relationships, right? I mean, why would you not want to know about that?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it too, of acknowledging that sex can be an awesome addition to people's lives, that sex is the one place where we feel like the least someone knows, the better they'll be able to make decisions. Because that doesn't apply to anything else, right? The more you know, the more responsible your choices will be, and the more in your favor they're going to be, the less likely you are to be swayed by other people's interpretation of who you are and what you should be doing for you. So I think that whenever parents get really scared of sex education and kind of want to shut it down, just, you have to acknowledge that the alternate to knowing nothing is allowing anybody who comes in your life to tell you who you are and what you should be doing.
Shan Boodram, YouTube personality, intimacy expert, sexologist. Shan, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us about it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing with me, Steve. You're part of the solution.
All right. Exhale. What are your thoughts about sex education these days? Too much? Much needed? Share your thoughts with us at kcrw.com/greaterLA. All right, coming up, LA gets a bad rap when it comes to pizza, but we roll out the defense. Yeah, we roll it out next on Greater LA. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Pizza. Pizza. It is one of our greatest love affairs. A relationship that humankind has with a simple bread crust or cauliflower crust, yes, I hear you, covered with sauce and whatever else you can throw on there. But LA does not have much street cred when it comes to pizza. Cities like New York and Chicago have their own distinct pies. What about LA? I know just the person to talk to about this. Mona Holmes, a regular contributor to Greater LA, who writes for Eater LA. Hi, Mona.
Hello, Steve.
Correct me if I'm wrong, by the way. Does LA have a pizza scene or any particular style? Like, I don't go to other cities in the world and it's like, hey, I want an LA style of pizza.
No, and you won't. But there's not a traditional style of pizza for Los Angeles, but we certainly have a ton of it right now.
We have a ton of pizza that's served.
Absolutely. And a ton of it that's really, really good. But there is this myth out there.
All right. What's the myth?
Okay. So the myth is that if you live in Los Angeles, this city does not have good pizza. And it usually comes from the mouth of someone from New York, Chicago, or San Francisco. And that LA pizza will never, ever amount to these aforementioned cities.
Especially San Francisco. We can't ever live up to San Francisco for some reason.
New Yorkers too, man. Man. And I'm probably, I'll hate my Twitter mentions in a moment, but New Yorkers are always ready and willing to make the argument that LA doesn't have good pizza, but they are ready for a good fight whenever it comes to defending its home turf. And this is absolutely the case with that.
So no particular style of pizza, but LA does have a lot of establishments that serve pizza.
Absolutely. I mean, there we do have some little quirky spots. Like there's this one place in Long Beach, unfortunately, it just closed last month, but they decided to do Cambodian pizza, and it was absolutely wonderful.
Wow.
There's a place in just outside of Koreatown that does birria pizzas, which is that wonderful Mexican stewed meat that's very saucy. I have no idea how it turns out, but it's been getting great reviews.
You said earlier that LA's pizza scene became established, like in recent years. For the longest time, we really didn't have a scene, and now we do. Give us an idea of when and how that happened.
Okay, so here's my theory, and I'd say that it is tried and true. Nancy Silverton, the wonderful chef, and Joe Bastianich opened Pizzeria Mazza in 2007, and Nancy is an award-winning, innovative chef, and what she was doing with pizza was wood-fired and also very new for Los Angeles. Celebrities went there, actual Dodger players went there. Everyone wanted to be there. And so she, I'd say, like, established the bar. And then in 2008, there was another wave of Jelena in Venice, that, along with 800 Degrees. And then in 2014, 2015, with places like Soto by Chef Steve Sampson, who owns Rosso Blu and Superfine Pizza in downtown. But these were all like the beginning, but it didn't really hit until 2017.
2017. So that was like the key year in LA pizza history.
Yes, sir.
I mean, is that what the Wikipedia page will say?
That's what I'm saying. I would arguably, it'd be really hard to find a food writer to say that Pizzana opening in Brentwood wasn't the beginning.
Pizzana?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And it was such an unlikely everything, like from the location in Brentwood, the Neapolitan style, the wood-fired pizza. Jonathan Gold, the late Jonathan Gold, thought it was outstanding and arguably the top spot for pizza in Los Angeles.
Oh, if Jonathan Gold had something to say about
Absolutely.
It, then yeah, that helped propel it, I'm sure.
But then from there, we just exploded with new pizzerias throughout the Southland and pretty much always made from a wood-fired oven.
So today, mm-hmm. here we are, 2020. What does this awesome landscape of pies look like in Los Angeles?
It'd be hard to, like, for example, I'll take Melrose.
Yeah.
Melrose between Robertson and La Brea or Highland.
Okay.
So starting with Mazza at the East End and with Ciccione's at the West End,
yeah.
On Robertson.
In WeHo.
Yes, in West Hollywood. And you can walk down that strip and you would stumble over a ton of pizzerias that make outstanding pizza. So there's places like Ronin, Spartina, Blackbird Pizza, all on that strip. There's also even a fairly newcomer, Antica Pizzeria, and this is the same one that was first noted at the Eat, Pray, Love novel and movie in Naples. There's also Roberta's. It's a wonderful New York transplant in Culver City. And, you know, there's just, you really can't get away from it right now. Like, I've mentioned all of these places, but they make outstanding pizza that could absolutely stand up to our rivals for sure.
So what's your favorite spot?
You know, I kind of mentioned it in passing, but it really does have to be Roberta's.
Really?
In Culver City. The chef, Carlo Maracci, he just manages to make pizzas with perfect crust and toppings that just hit. Just do it for me.
You save the best for last.
Yeah, and then the vibe in the room, you go in there and they're playing the Ramones, they're playing hip-hop, they're playing all kinds of things,
yeah.
And it's a really bright, sunny space that just makes you want to smile, so it has all the elements for me.
What are we having for dinner, huh?
You know what?
Yeah. Mona Holmes, one of our regulars here at Greater LA, reporter at Eater LA. Mona, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
By the way, what's your favorite pizza place? What kind of style do you like? Does LA have a pizza style? Check us out at kcrw.com and let us know. kcrw.com/AskGreaterLA. And while you're there, subscribe to the podcast, too. We'd love for you to have us in your inbox each and every day. We'll send it to you right along, and you can share your thoughts with us there. That is going to do it for us today. Next week, Kobe's memorial. Thousands will gather. We'll take you there. A preview of next month's big Golden State primary, and in search of black Republicans in California. Turns out there are quite a few. Our producers today are Jenna Cagle and Danielle Chiriguayo. Our editor is Sonia Geis. Amy Ta is part of our web team. Phil Richards and Ray Guarna mix and engineer the show. Christine Comito keeps us on time. Thank you, Christine. Christian Bordahl oversees everything. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and for your ears. Have yourself a great Thursday.